Good morning, welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universal Society. Prairie is an independent member of the Unitarian Universalist Association. We're a lay-led society for our visitors today. We have no minister. Our programs are presented primarily by members of our congregation. We do have a religious education program for children, nursery school, and then K through 8. Starting right off with a hymn, aren't we, Delia? Level 7. Now we sing the brave of old.
Joys and sorrows.
Delia.
I have a sorrow that Susan wasn't here because we thought that he was going to be at the end of the night. Joy, Kay and I are both going to be here at the same time, but we need to move our solo up earlier than normal because I have to leave. There's no other place I can stay. This is so. I'm sorry, I didn't know. Very neat. Where would you like it moved up to? Maybe after Joyce's. Before the discussion? After the discussion?
Before the discussion, in place of the discussion.
Betty?
That's good.
This is Joy Sorrow, also introduction of guests and visitors. I am a member of 18 years ago. I left here in 1977. My name is Chuck Young. So I know about a third of the people here. And so it's a joy to come back and see how well you're doing through the building and so forth. And then the occasion is a sorrowful one that my wife's father, Bernard Sumi, passed away a couple of weeks ago, and yesterday was a big memorial service for him at Luther Memorial. And I want him in sorrow, but it's a joy to see that he's well remembered in the community, and the family will be supported by friends and other family well into the future. So it's nice to see you all again, Paul.
Yes. Can you speak up?
Barb's weird phone. She had to get open heart surgery and had complications.
My boy is that it's cold pressure.
Yeah.
Cold pressure.
I have a joy. I've come back from a trip to Albuquerque where I used for the third time the Unitarian Universalist directory called Homecomings, a bed and breakfast where you can stay for much less than hotels. This time, the woman who owned the house just four blocks from the son I wanted to visit, she took my deposit. We made arrangements in the spring, and then she called me up long distance and said, "You know, I'm going to be at a Unitarian Universalist retreat in the mountains of Colorado that week. But if you want to come anyway, I'll leave the house open." She left her beautifully furnished house open day and night for us to use. It was delightful. That's the third time I've used home.
Yes, Kay.
I got a quick joke. Delita and her other fellows from the Ethnic Connection came out and played yesterday at Lake Mills. During a rousy thunderstorm, I was afraid they were going to get electrocuted to death.
Likewise, any inheritance that a parent or relative leaves you
automatically becomes his property. He can apprentice a child without your consent, and though divorce is rare, should you have one, your husband will receive custody of the children automatically. If you protest any mistreatment or battering by your husband, the courts will consider that's unfortunate, but they won't intervene. You'd have slightly more freedom, but less status if you remain unmarried. Spinsters, derogatorily nicknamed, quote, old maids, are scorned and pitied for not fulfilling a woman's natural function by taking care of a husband and children. As a single woman, you're expected to remain under your father's roof, and after his death, a relative, sometimes willingly, but often not willingly, will take you in. Because you have little education, there's almost no opportunity for work. And if you have to support yourself, you will be either a domestic, a seamstress, or a teacher, depending upon your station in life. And any money or property left to you will probably be administered by a male guardian who can spend it or dispense it at his will. I'm going to read a line or two that was written in 1776 by Abigail Adams to her husband John Adams at the time John was down in Philadelphia trying to put together our Constitution. And Abigail said in her letter, "Do not put unlimited power into the hands of the husbands. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion, and we will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation." The women of the century after Abigail Adams did not hold themselves so bound. And as a result, they suffered many difficulties, as in the arrest of Susan B. Anthony in 1872.
Yes?
Are you Miss Anthony?
Which Miss Anthony do you want? I'm Susan Anthony, but my sister Mary Anthony also lives here.
I wish to speak to both Miss Anthony's. I'm Chief Marshal Keeney of the Federal Court, and by order of the court, I must serve summonses to the 16 women who, in defiance of the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, went to Rochester, New York Courthouse on November 1st, 1872, registered to vote, and then voted on November 5th.
Only 16 summonses? Why, there were 50 of us who registered. Of course, only the ladies who live in my precinct managed to actually vote. But not because they didn't try.
Look, I'm not enjoying this part of my job, what with it being Thanksgiving Day. I could just give you the summonses, and you and your sister can come on down to the station later on your own.
On my own? Indeed not. I am an American citizen, and therefore have the right to vote, a right which the state cannot deny me. If either the state or the national government thinks differently, then you must arrest me and force me to appear in court and stand trial.
At the time of this occurrence that you just heard, the nucleus group of the NAWSA, which is the National Association for Women's Suffrage Association, had been active for about 24 years since its inception at Seneca Falls, New York, at a meeting organized by Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. This meeting was attended by 300 people, many of them men, who were sympathetic to the cause of women's suffrage. And it should be noted that while Susan Anthony was being arrested in New York, the women of Wyoming had already been given the vote 2 years before. I'll have something to say about that a little later. We had 68 women and 32 men who signed the Declaration, more or less Declaration of Independence for Women's equality. So this was not just a woman's struggle, there were also men who were sympathetic to their cause. Up until the ratification of the 14th and 15th Amendments, the suffrage battle had consisted for the most part of lining up people who were sympathetic to the cause and then begging men to give women the vote. A new strategy was based upon the theory that since the Constitution did not deny women citizenship, it could not deny them the rights which pertain to citizenship. This was the defense that Susan would use upon her arrest, which you just saw, of her for her voting without having the legal right. And I might mention here that the change in attitude and strategy actually was something that came about because of the passage of the 14th and 15th Amendments. And that is when the slaves were given the right to vote, a couple of things happened within the movement. One being the fact that the women who had been working at this for 24 years felt, as many of them, that the slaves who were, for the most part, uneducated and some who were illiterate, were given the right to vote, and yet the women were felt, many of whom were very well educated, were not felt to be on an equal footing with the freed slaves. And so at that point, a sort of change in the strategy of how the suffrage movement worked went on. Susan, when she was arrested, was given the privilege of being the representative of all of the 16 women who were summoned. And she appeared before the grand jury, was indicted, and she was bound over for trial. So the district attorney asked for the seat to change of venue to ensure that the trial would be a fair one, because the people in the suffrage movement had been fomenting a lot of publicity, and there was a great deal to do in that county to try and influence people to vote to free Susan Anthony. So they moved the trial to another location. A jury was selected, and of course the jury was all white men. And the trial began. And
all your witnesses.
I call the stand Miss Susan Anthony.
That will not be allowed.
Why is that, Your Honor?
She is not a competent witness.
Not competent? Why on earth not, Your Honor?
Because she is a woman. Please resume your seat, Mr.
I object, Your Honor.
Your objection is overruled. Let us move on.
Both sides finished their arguments in this trial, and Susan Anthony did not and was not permitted to take the witness stand in her own behalf.
Gentlemen of the jury, you need not retire from the courtroom, as there is no decision you must make. The jury's job is to consider questions of facts. There are no questions of facts in this case for you to consider. My job is to rule on questions of law. Since Miss Anthony's belief and the advice she took do not protect her in the act she committed, I direct you to give me a verdict of guilty.
I object.
Your objection is overruled. Overruled. Clerk, you will read the statement I'm handing you to the jury.
I'll be clerk because I forgot to Xerox today. So, jury, you are to say that you found the defendant guilty of the offense whereof she stands indicted, and so say you all.
Your Honor, I object again and again. I request an individual jury count and poll.
There will be no such poll. The jury is dismissed. Does the defendant have anything to say as to why sentence should not be pronounced?
Yes, Your Honor. I have many things to say. For in your ordered verdict of guilt, you have trampled underfoot every vital principle of our government. Your denial of my citizen's right to vote is the denial of my right of consent as one of the governed, the denial of my right to a trial by jury of my peers, the denial of my sacred rights to life, liberty, and property. all my prosecutors from the 8th Ward Corner Grocery Store politician who entered the complaint to the U.S. Marshal, Commissioner, District Attorney, District Judge, and Your Honor on the bench. Not one is my peer, but each and all my political sovereigns. And had Your Honor submitted my case to the jury, as was clearly your duty, even then I should have had just cause to protest. For not one of those men was my peer. But native or foreign, white or black, rich or poor, educated or ignorant, awake or asleep, sober or drunk, each and every man of them was my political superior, hence in no sense my peer.
You have been tried according to the established forms of law.
By forms of law made by men, administered by men, in favor of men and against women. Yesterday, that same man-made form of law declared it a crime for you or me to give a cup of cold water to a panting fugitive while he was tracking his way to Canada. And every man and woman in whose veins coursed a drop of human sympathy violated that wicked law and was justified in so doing. And then, the slaves who got their freedom must take it over or under or through the unjust forms of law. Precisely so now must women get their right to a voice in this government taken. And I have taken mine and mean to take it at every opportunity.
That is enough, Ms. Anthony. Take your seat.
When I was brought before Your Honor for trial, I hoped for a broad and liberal interpretation of the Constitution and its recent amendments that should declare all U.S. citizens under its protecting aegis. That should declare equality of rights to all persons born or naturalized in the United States. But failing to get this justice, failing even to get a trial by a jury not of my peers, I ask not leniency at your hands, but to take the full rigors of the law.
You are hereby sentenced to pay a fine $100 in court costs.
May it please Your Honor, I shall never pay a dollar of your unjust pay. And I shall earnestly and persistently continue to urge all women to the practical recognition of the old revolutionary maxim that resistance to tyrants is obedience to God.
As a footnote to that, Susan's sentence was never carried out, and Judge Hunt took no steps to enforce it, and the cases against the other 15 women were dropped. Doors were slammed in their faces. Often only a handful of people attended their meetings. They were jeered at and mocked. They were pelted with mud and eggs and rotten fruit. They were put in jail. They were starved. They were beaten. All kinds of terrible things. Often they were given the choice of going to jail or something else, and they chose to go to jail. And the conditions in the jails were just terrible. I'm going to often, even the women on whose behalf these suffrage women were waging this battle were against them. And on this videotape that I'm about to show, which if I take it out of my purse here, I'll let everyone. On this videotape, you will hear the speech given by one such woman before Congress in the congressional hearings of 1913. I happened to turn on my TV last night and I noticed that this was being played on Channel 4, so I hope none of you had good TV on at the same time and saw this before. But while she's speaking, the TV screen will also show you some of the thousands of cartoons and jibes and jokes, posters and flyers that were making fun of the suffragettes at the time and decrying the idea of giving women the vote.
Thank you.
put that on stage so we can go back and see.
Section 1. The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Section 2. The Congress shall have power by appropriate legislation to enforce the provisions of this article. Now, we will hear a discussion of the question of equal suffrage by those who are opposed to the measure. First, Mrs. Kate Douglas Wiggin of New York. Mrs. Wiggin.
Author of Sunnybrook Farm,
Mr. Chairman and gentlemen of the committee, before starting the arguments on our side, I should like to read a short statement of the National Association which I represent. The National Association opposed to woman suffrage was organized in November 1912 for the purpose of organizing opposition to woman suffrage. The majority of our members, probably two-thirds, are self-supporting or wage-earning women. We believe we voice the opinion of a majority of women in this country who think we serve the state and community and humanity best when we stay out of public life or politics. The anti-suffragists are active in all lines of charitable, educational, civic, and municipal work. Anti-suffragists have not withdrawn their contribution of money or time or services from these other channels to devote themselves to anti-suffrage work. But the suffragists have done so in many cases to work for the suffrage cause. In fact, to such an increasing degree that we sometimes think that if suffrage is not brought very soon to these women, the men and the anti-suffragists will be the only ones left to conduct these enterprises along larger and broader lines. Now, Mr. Chairman, I shall ask your consideration of the arguments that we have to present. I am probably an anti-suffragist by instinct and temperament, but all the experience of my busy life has confirmed my natural attitude of mind. I would not for the world retard the development of woman, nor hamper her in her struggle for still greater freedom than she now possesses, though to my mind she has not at any time gone to the limit of her powers under present conditions. But I cannot believe that the ballot is the first or the next or the best thing to work for. I want her to be a good homemaker, a good mother, and a loyal, intelligent, active citizen. But above all, to be a helpful, stimulating, inspiring force in the world rather than a useful and influential factor in politics. I do not question a woman's ability to concentrate her mind on political questions, to grow steadily in knowledge and power, and to vote wisely and conscientiously. But I would prefer her to develop still higher powers, for there are higher ones. It is even more difficult to be an inspiring woman than a good citizen and an honest voter. And if you declare your ability to be all three, I shall continue to believe that the first of the three will continually be lost in the development of the other two. Nobody can say that the services of local or national government demand as concentrated a use of woman's powers as the service of humanity. A woman's job, to my mind, is with other women, with children, and with men who, next to children, are most dependent upon what she thinks and says and does and is. Her peculiar job, I say, is with men, women, and children, their bodies, their hearts, and their souls. I would have a woman strong enough to bear the burden of the weak, to rescue and educate derelicts, to make life cleaner, safer, saner, more upright than it is now. I would have her strong enough to keep just a trifle in the background. She spoils the composition of many a good picture just now by wanting the center of the stage and all the limelight that the electrician can furnish. The limelight never makes anything grow. It only causes the thing to look a little different than it is. If woman is as strong as she ought to be, she should be called continually in council to advise, to consult, and cooperate with men wherever her peculiar gifts are valuable. If she enjoys and uses these rights and privileges, she does not need the ballot. If woman's suffrage is granted, you are putting every woman into politics, even if she only votes once. There will be a time when some friend or husband of a friend or some friend's enemy is running for office, and she will be forced to enter politics, at least to the extent of voting, of voicing her opinion at the polls. The suffragists tell us this is not a serious matter, that it is a sentimental matter that makes us object, and that we will get over it. In fact, they say the solution of the question is that we will get used to it. Now, gentlemen of the committee, I believe I am not exaggerating when I say that when the time comes that women get used to such attacks, when they get used to being called liars and thieves and bribers in the papers and by politicians, as men politicians are called and must expect to be called if they are in politics, when the women get used to that, we will reach a point of tragedy in the history of this country. When both sides are forced to lose their sensibility to public attack and public opinion. When women are forced to become as hardened and callous as men in the warfare of politics, it means a tragedy for the future generations of this country. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs.
I want to stop. There's another. Other side of the story, which comes everybody. Well, thank God Mrs. Wiggins is dead. But while people like her were waging battle against the right of women to vote, progress was being made in other quarters. Surprisingly, it was not among the sophisticated, educated, and cosmopolitan peoples of the East that this progress was being made. Rather, it was out on the Western frontier. And the Western frontier led the way. In 1868, the territory of Wyoming, with a minimum of opposition, and despite the fact that men outnumbered the women 6-1 in the territory, introduced and passed a bill giving women the same political rights as men. And despite the pressure to veto that bill, Governor John Campbell of the territory refused to do so. And thus, in 1869, the Wyoming Territory became the first government of the United States to give women the vote. And when Wyoming became a state 20 years later, it retained its women's suffrage laws in its state constitution. We have someone from Wyoming in our amongst our congregation, and that's a very wonderful heritage. Yes, ma'am.
Is it known that the population of women changed after that? In Wyoming?
It may be known, but not by me. I'm sure it's somewhere in the census, but I don't know.
It did change, and the ratio.
do with the way the vote went.
They want to entice more.
Yes, that's what he said, that they were, that, I mean, I'm not.
That's only part of it.
Yeah, I get the impression that that's one of the things that the reasons that's given and whether that was really true or not.
It may not have been enough, we're thinking it anyway.
The initiators were genuine.
And it was a very small little mining town, mining camp that where this whole thing began. So they did a wonderful thing. However, the problem arose when Wyoming sought admission to the Union as a state. And actually, if anyone were a script writer here, as I was reading through some of this, it would make the most wonderful film script, because they just went through so much between the territorial government and the United States government in Washington, arguing and fighting over the admission to the Union, all because of this women's suffrage. And what the attitude of people in Washington was, they were aghast. I mean, the women in this state would be able to vote. For God's sakes, what's going to happen if they voted a woman into Congress? What would we do if somebody came to Washington? How would we address them? How would we talk to them? How could they go to the bathroom?
No.
What a problem if we do that? Yeah, okay. Heaven forbid, these things should happen. And this controversy went on for quite a while. It was very, very bitter. And it actually came down to the point where they were on the verge of having to make a choice between whether they wanted to be admitted to the Union or whether they would get rid of their women's suffrage. And the representative in Washington immediately went back to the governor of the territory and said, how should I vote on this? Which one do we get rid of women's suffrage, or do we come into the Union? And this is where our Wyoming resident should really feel so proud that the legislature of Wyoming said, we will stay out of the Union for the next 100 years. We would rather not be a state than to deprive the women in our territory of their voting privileges. And at the time when that was said, that ended the entire debate, and after a while, Congress finally did admit Wyoming to the Union with the suffrage in their constitution intact. So, 3 years after Wyoming came into the Union, Colorado granted women the vote. That was followed by Utah, then Idaho, and another 14 years later, the state of Washington granted suffrage, followed by California. So it was the western frontier lands where the freedom and equality for women was first made.
What time period is that?
That's in the late 1800s. Colorado granted the vote in 1893. Washington, are you originally from Washington?
No, Southern California.
Okay.
But my parents are from Colorado.
I think Washington granted it in 1910 and California in 1911. By this time, we were starting to get a new generation of women who were working on suffrage. And as I mentioned earlier, it was right during and after the Korean Civil War that there was a shift in philosophy and in how they went about trying to achieve their goals. This new generation was led by Perry Chapman Catt, who was also the founder of the League of Women Voters and was from Wisconsin. It's hard in a short time allotted to adequately describe the obstacles and the victories of the women who devoted their lives and their energies, and the men also, so that those who came after them could enjoy the privileges of full citizenship. The main, four main pioneers of the movement, Elizabeth K. Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, Lucy Stowe, and Lucretia Mott, never got to cast a legal vote after suffrage was. They had all died by the time this finally came to fruition. But it's because of them that we're able to do so. And the next part of our tape here is a Wisconsin woman who is speaking before the same hearing that you heard the first speaker. And this is the pro-suffrage plea.
Your discussion of the question of equal suffrage by those who are in favor of the measure. Mrs. Belle Chase LaFont of Wisconsin. Mrs. LaFont.
For nearly half a century, the women of this nation have come here, year after year, at every session of Congress, making this claim. That the women citizens of the United States, equally with the men citizens, are interested in the government and are interested in securing the right to express their will in regard to the form of government under which they shall live. In this struggle for equal suffrage, the real issue is not, it seems to me, whether all women are asking for the vote or whether all men are demanding it for them, but whether it is in the interest of the home, of society, of government, that the people as a whole shall participate in making the laws that govern them as a whole. It is a question of democracy. My basic reason for believing in equal suffrage is that it will make better homes. The home is the basis of society. Government exists for society. In the early pioneer days, when all the work was done in the home, and women wove and spun and prepared the food and made the candles, the home was an independent unit. Indeed, government touched the common life very little then, except as it gave title to the land and demanded military service and taxed the people to pay the expenses of war. But in modern complex life, government touches its every phase. The government of the township and the city today are very largely questions of public housekeeping. Roads, schools, streetcar service, gas, electric lights, markets, all are questions in which women primarily should be interested, at least equally with men. What is true of the town and of the city is true of the state. State taxes, state education, state control of public utilities, railway service, telephone and telegraph, insurance, and industrial commissions are all questions that affect directly the happiness and the comfort of the home. Women do most of the buying. When we buy a gallon of oil, a yard of cloth, a pound of sugar, we are up against an economic problem the same as when those questions are considered by you in the United States Senate. Now, think of the enormous waste of time, of effort, of nervous energy on the part of women who have been taught by tradition that these are personal, individual problems which they can settle by haggling with the butcher and the grocer and haunting the bargain counter. Why talk about women not having the time to vote? Women waste more time in this fruitless effort to make both ends meet than it would take them to vote every day of the year and prepare themselves to understand all the great questions before the country. And when it comes to national affairs, I cannot think of a single important question that has been before the Congress of the United States in the last 25 years in which women have not been equally concerned with men. Women's direct influence in legislation would supplement the work of men, and make our government more regardful of the general human welfare. Home, society, government are best where men and women keep together intellectually and spiritually, where they have the widest range of common interests, where they share with each other the solution of their common problems. I am not one of those who expect any great radical change because of people's suffrage. That is, any great radical immediate change. It has always seemed to me very natural that women and men of the same family should have somewhat similar views on political questions, much as fathers and sons and brothers now do. It is to the general uplift that we must look for the great benefit of equal suffrage. Granting equal opportunities to women in education, and that movement for your I'm very generous in listening to the extended discussion of the subject in all its phases. But I wonder if, after all has been said, you will not agree that it resolves itself into a simple matter of common sense. Participation in government is just a question of patriotism, love of our community, loyalty to our state, and devotion to our nation. You know how Lincoln defined government at Gettysburg. Ours is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And are not women people. Government is not a man's problem, nor a woman's problem alone. It is their mutual problem. And it is only when women are given their share of responsibility in the solution of public questions that the affairs of government will be brought into the home for discussion. Not until then will government become a familiar subject, interwoven in the family life and understood as it must be. In democracy, in its best form, is to endure. I thank you.
This was in 1913. That was the third time that that amendment had gone to Congress, and it lost again. So, on January 10th, 1918, it went to the House floor for the fourth time. And this time it was passed almost immediately in the House. This victory in the House was highly celebrated, but was followed by a year and a half of intense dispute before it was passed by the U.S. Senate on June 4, 1919. To become law, it had to be ratified by 36 states. And by March of 1920, 35 states had ratified it. 8 states voted against ratification. Of the remaining 5 states, the governors of Connecticut and Vermont refused to convene the legislature to even consider ratification. 2 states, I meant to look those 2 up, and I guess it got too early in the morning, and I didn't. But 2 states were considered hopeless, and the last resort was the state of Tennessee, which was bitterly divided on the issue and was sitting on the fence. The final suffrage battle was waged there. It was a very bitter one. All kinds of terrible things happened, underhanded politically, et cetera, until actually they had forced an injunction to prevent the governor from signing the bill even after it was passed. But on the 24th of August, the governor finally signed the certificate of ratification, sent it to Washington, D.C., where it arrived at 4 a.m. in the morning, and by 8 a.m. that same day, the Secretary of State had signed it and gave 17 million women the right of citizenship, freeing them from political slavery. And that's this story as I plan to tell it. There's much more to this. There's no way you can tell all of this whole story. It's really a wonderful one. I would like to have, do you want to do the, we'll do the song now. I'd like to say a word about the song that Kate Frazier is going to sing for us and the leader will play. This song was once known in your hymn book. It's called Lift Every Voice and Sing. It was known as the Negro National Anthem for many, many years. And it was a song that was always played at every black occasion and was hardly known in the white community. I chose it this morning because I think what makes a good song is its universality. And I really felt that the verses of this song lent themselves to the struggle for women's equality as well as the struggle for other kinds of civil rights. So, and it's always a treat to have Kay sing for us. So.
It's being called the Black Man Find the Mountain.
Is it also, I'm sure it's still retained, but it's also in our book, it's called The Fair.
Drawn out by the vision of what might now be.
Those who live
before us, who struggled for justice and suffered injustice before us, have not melted into the dust and have not disappeared.
They are with us still, and the lives they live hold us steady.
Their words remind us and call us back to ourselves. Their courage and love be both our own. We, the living, carry them with us. We are their voices, their hands, and their hearts.
We retake them with us, and we with them choose to be the path of living.
And those that I have in mind in reading and doing this service are the pioneers of this woman's suffrage movement, Lucretia Mott, Lucy Stowe, Carrie Chapman, Stanton, Katie Stanton, and Susan B. Anthony, the Wisconsin Ms. Cat, and all of the women and men who spoke so valiantly for women's rights. And I'd like to turn the program back over to Rick now. Thank you. That's going beyond the scope of this program, I think. But I have a question. If anyone can tell me, when did Wisconsin ratify and grant suffrage to women? Barbara, Mary?
It was very close to being first. It was delivered by hand, and Illinois got there a half an hour earlier.
Oh, not really.
I spent months in the Historical Society going to voting papers. You used to have to sign your name and ink, you know, when you went to the polling place. And it's like stuff so everybody can hear
you.
Okay, in the western part of Wisconsin, I went to all the voting papers at the Historical Society. You know the papers, I mean, they have them for every county. And the area around La Crosse, Crawford, and Vernon County, the interesting thing was that before there was national suffrage, there was local suffrage for women. And the interesting part about that is that where it was not in the cities. In the cities, you see man after man's name, just men, on the rolls, and you see Mr. and Mrs., Mr. and Mrs., Mr. and Mrs. again and again in the country. And the reason for that was there were local elections in the country, things like school board and agrarian matters to deal with. And in the country, the men and the women worked together, and they were of equal importance in working on the land. An extra hand was just too vital to be looked down upon or considered minor.
Are you talking about Wisconsin?
Oh, okay. I am talking about Wisconsin, rural Wisconsin, as opposed to urban Wisconsin and the western part of the southern part of the state of Mississippi. I know for a fact that in the late 1800s, there was equal suffrage for women, and that it came in rural rather than urban counties long before we get it nationally. And I thought that was really fascinating. We were early.
Actually, women had the vote in a lot of communities in the early part of the 19th century, and somewhere around 1813 or 1815, lost their voting rights. But evidently in Wisconsin, they continued to hold on to those. Who's somebody like Mary? Did you have your hand up? George.
Listening to the woman proposing the anti-suffrage notion made me realize that the same arguments seem to be used for every expansion of women's rights. And the argument is based on the notion that women are supposed to remain pure and virginal, and they must be protected from the harshness and dirtiness of real life. My daughter Martha was very athletic at the university. She was a member of the basketball team, the volleyball team, and the women athletes were only allowed to participate in intramural, that is, within the university competition, and they wanted to play against other colleges. The women's athletic department, with Hermine Davidson at the forefront, opposed this, using exactly the same arguments, that women don't want to enter the dirty world of competition. Women should uphold the true soul of sports and not compete against the other. So we have the same old story going on over and over.
And I think the same arguments that you mentioned, ERA, I know. The leader? Oh, I'm sorry. I told him.
I can remember my father trying to teach my mother to drive, but she never followed up on it. She didn't think she wanted to do it. And I can remember the term, just a woman driver.
I think I still feel that term.
Well, when you drive, yes.
Was that the politics was done in the saloons, because that was one of the major meeting places, and there weren't churches at that time. The women established the churches and eventually established the schools, but the politics was done in the saloons. The women didn't, you know, they wouldn't want to vote in the saloons, so that therefore, also the voting, of course, is not secret ballots, but everybody knew how to vote. Esther Hobart Morris in South Pass City was the one who supposedly initiated it, but the sad thing is that no one wrote down the history of it at the time. So it's hard, very, very hard to document it. My parents were on the forefront of trying to document as much as they could about finding suffrage. The biggest problem came when, along with suffrage, comes another responsibility, and that's jury duty. And the biggest problem came when women in Wyoming began to serve on juries, and all hell broke loose. And so they said that the judges simply did an appointment for juries, and it wasn't until the 1950s that, except for a trial where a woman was the defendant, it wasn't until the 1950s that women began to serve regularly on juries where the defendants were men.
That's very interesting. And of course, the reason that they didn't want them on the juries was because they were afraid that, you know, that there was the temperance movement going on. And they were afraid that the women would vote against the use of alcohol and so forth and so on, closing and close down some saloons. Who else had their hand up here?
I'm going to betray my ignorance in my Unitarian Universalist groups. Does anybody know which ones of our foremothers were Unitarian?
I don't think any of those four were.
What
were
the Quakers?
All except one were Quakers. One of them, I believe it was Elizabeth Cady Stanton, was a Methodist. I believe she was a Methodist. Someone want to clarify that? But the other, Lucy Stone, Mott, and Anthony, I think, were Quakers.
We can claim Susan B. Susan B. Anthony was Unitarian.
No, she attended Unitarian churches, which she never joined. Okay. She was always a Quaker for
clarifying. She looks a lot like most Unitarians.
Right, exactly.
Who else had anyone? Mary?
I was going to say that this issue really started with the first Constitutional Convention.
Yeah, that's why I read the Abigail Adams. So that whole question was there. And I don't. Does the Constitution actually say men? Is the word males?
Well, they were trying to get in a clause over the property rights of married women. And the first convention dissolved in complete confusion because there was such terrible disagreement. Also, the rights of blacks to vote. I don't know if it's just to vote or whatever.
Well,
so the second convention, they didn't touch it, they left it alone.
Yeah.
And when the first legislature, it passed the Marriage and Women's Property Rights.
When they say all men, the question is, all men white, generic, yeah. Or is men, do they literally mean men?
Yeah. There's an historical
men,
argument,
but not women.
There's an historical argument that it did, that in the minds of the framers, of the writers of the Declaration, it was all white men who owned property.
Before I need to cut off the discussion, but I would like to give some thanks to the people who read for me. Also to mention that the videotape was done by, put together and produced by Jocelyn Riley here in Madison. It's available at the public library if anyone would like to borrow it or use it for some other occasion. And I would also like to mention, I didn't bring my League of Women Voters newsletter with me, but next Saturday, I believe, there's a big rally down at the demonstration, et cetera, celebration down at the Capitol. The actual commemoration is next Saturday, but we weren't able to do this program on it. I'm going to turn it back over.
I just want to say I thought the whole thing was pretty biased. I thought that Mrs. Wiggins made some good points.
I think that's what's
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Before we move on, Barb, before you came, returned to the VCR, Judy mentioned to us that your nephew had died. Would you give us his name and tell us something about it?
Many of you have met my brother Warren, including Janos here, who probably got the grant. He had his son Warren with a heart defect. He's 17 years old, and he was a little heart surgery a week ago, and died on Saturday. The Memorial Service at First University Society in Minneapolis was very supportive. Misha played a solo beautiful contribution to the music. But I miss Jonathan.
Thank you. I'm going to start the collection baskets around. And I've warned some of our guests and visitors today that we do encourage their introductions and tell us how they, their names and how they happen to get here. We welcome them. So if anyone would like to begin. Yes,
Mark and Kathy Horn. Glad to be
here.
Mark and Kathy Horn.
Yeah.
And Lee Pat. And we're back in town to visit the family to get to know Madison again.
Well, great. Welcome back.
Yes.
We'll probably be here next week, too, maybe.
My daughter Jennifer, visiting from Seattle, young Prairie Paul from way back.
Yeah.
Kathy Sutter, I'm a married farmer from rural Montpelier, about half hour away. And I'm glad to be here, and thank you very much for the talk.
Thank you.
two large bags of this wonderful cinnamon